This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Kringle is Wisconsin's official pastry, but the cream puff gets a lot of hype thanks in large part to the state fair. We'll get to the bottom of a listener question about the real Wisconsin pastry, and you could share your favorite. Now, Democrats are working to secure enough votes for a new tax on the very, very wealthy. Under 1,000 of the richest Americans would see taxes on unrealized earnings, like stocks, for example, before they're sold and the money is actually made. The biggest hit would come to about the top 10 wealthiest Americans. Supporters say it would help pay part of the roughly $2 trillion in new spending on social policy and climate initiatives. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told CNN over the weekend that the tax, as proposed, would actually be a relatively small part of the funding.
We probably will have a wealth tax,
yeah.
But again, it's only 10% of what we need. The other things are more like $800 billion versus $200 billion. But we can use them another time. They don't go away as a source of revenue to pay for how we go forward.
Republicans and some tax experts say the idea could be unconstitutional and that it might have unintended consequences, including for those who aren't very wealthy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Is a new tax in some form on the richest Americans a good idea? Should we be taxing increases in wealth, even if they haven't been converted into actual money? Does it make more sense to raise corporate or individual tax rates instead? Or is raising any taxes on anyone a bad idea? Maybe the spending plan you think ought to be scrapped? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Primo is the Ani and Mark Gabrielian Professor and Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester. David, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be back with you.
There's a lot of moving parts here and plans are changing from moment to moment. I want to start out with some of the basics. When we use the phrase a wealth tax, what exactly do we mean by that?
Yeah, I agree that things are moving by the minute here. And I sort of came on with some trepidation because this new proposal is really a moving target.
Right.
When we traditionally have heard the term wealth tax in recent years, it has been a set of proposals by liberals and Democrats that would assess the wealth of taxpayers every year. And for the wealthiest taxpayers, they would essentially pay a tax on their net worth each year. And that's different from what's being proposed in the current budget bill, right, which Nancy Pelosi and others have also called a wealth tax. But that tax is really a tax on what are called unrealized capital gains. So stocks you haven't sold yet and you've got some gains on them. The government wants to now tax potentially those gains before you've actually sold the stock. But let me go back to the initial idea of the wealth tax. The initial idea of the wealth tax that's been proposed in the past couple of years was, again, we want to make sure that the argument would be we want to make sure the wealthiest Americans are contributing their fair share would be the argument to contributing to the tax coffers. And so to do that, because the belief is that the wealthiest taxpayers have the ability to avoid taxation in ways that the average American doesn't, we're going to assess their wealth every year, and that's going to be a lot harder than to avoid taxation.
Yeah, what do you think of the concept in principle? Yeah,
There are serious constitutional issues with that concept. There are serious operational concerns with that concept. But at the very least, I will say, at least you can conceptually understand how it might operate. I have a very different perception of the current proposal that's in the budget negotiations right now, which is to tax unrealized capital gains.
Right.
That proposal, the proposal that's currently being considered, seems like something that was drummed up at the 11th hour to appease the necessary Democrats to get enough support to have it pass the Senate. It is not particularly a well thought out proposal. There are a lot of complexities to it. There will be a lot of complexities to the wealth tax, but it makes more sense, frankly, than this current proposal, which would tax unrealized capital gains. And we can get into some of the details in a minute, but the bottom line is there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how it would be implemented. And again, as with the wealth tax, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether or not it's actually constitutional.
Yeah, breaking down how that might work. So, I've started this vast high-tech company, and I've had myself paid with a lot of shares in stock as opposed to just money. This unrealized gain tax, if my Robco stocks went up this year, I would be taxed based on how much they went up, even if I didn't go and sell those stocks, which is usually what I'd have to do to get them taxed. Do I have that about right?
That is about right. But let's get into this. Let's get into this example a little bit. So the first, you'd have to have earned over $100 million for 3 years in a row, or have over $1 billion in wealth for this tax to apply to you. So the idea is this is going to apply to the richest of the rich.
Right.
So let's suppose you're in that camp.
Robco's doing great.
So
yeah.
Exactly. You know, and the way it would work at that point is that somebody, right, let's say that this is a privately held company. So if you've got stocks out there, then it's pretty easy to estimate your gains. But let's suppose that you're a privately held company, meaning you don't sell your shares on the public exchanges. How do we know that your company went up by that much in value? Who's going to determine what the value of a privately held company is? And, you know, just looking down the game tree, as an economist would say, what's going to happen is the IRS is going to say, well, we think your Robco's done really well, and your company's worth $100 million more this year. And you're going to say, well, no, I'm going to hire some tax accountant, tax lawyers to show you actually, no, this company's only gone up in value by $10 million this year. And so this is just going to spawn, let's say that about 700 taxpayers are subject to this tax, it's going to spawn 700 lawsuits and battles over exactly how much is owed. That's the first problem with this is operationally.
Talking to David Primo with the University of Rochester, looking at the idea of some form of wealth type tax on wealthier Americans, and a particular Democratic proposal right now in the ongoing negotiations over infrastructure and human services investment for a tax on unrealized gains. So you were saying that was the first problem, David. The operational one? You mentioned the constitutional problems. Anything else leaping to your mind?
Yeah, we could spend an hour on this. So the next problem that you're going to face. So now you've got these battles with the IRS and sort of figuring out exactly how we're going to measure the gains of privately held companies. But then you've got a third problem, which is that the government cannot be, you can't believe politicians when they say that, oh, but this is only going to apply to the wealthiest Americans, because this is also what was said about the income tax when it was instituted in the early 1900s. What's going to happen is the government, if this does actually work, so let's say they work out the operational concerns and the constitutional concerns, now all of a sudden you've set a precedent for taxing unrealized capital gains. And you can imagine that all of a sudden the definition of what is wealthy will continue to be ratcheted down until it affects a wide swath of Americans, because this is going to be an irresistible revenue source for elected officials. So why would they need the extra revenue? Because the fact is, as Nancy Pelosi hinted at in the clip that you played at the outset, this is, quote, only going to raise $250 billion dollars over 10 years, I believe, is the estimate. And that is just a drop in the bucket compared with the hundreds of trillions of dollars of debt that the country is going to take on in the next 30 to 40 years. So it may be politically popular to say we're going to tax the wealthy, but the reality is, to actually cover the costs of our long-run obligations with Social Security, with Medicare, put aside the new proposals for spending that are in this budget, just to pay our existing obligations is going to take a massive amount of revenue. And so this could be sort of a way to introduce the idea of saying we're now going to tax investments in an entirely different way, and that's going to change the relationship between Americans and the government with respect to investment, and that could have really negative effects on the U.S. economy.
I want to give a listen to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on CNN here on Sunday.
I wouldn't call that a wealth tax, but it would help get at capital gains, which are an extraordinarily large part of the incomes of the wealthiest individuals. And right now, escape taxation until they're realized.
So big picture, is there something to the argument that these wealthiest Americans would be affected by the current proposal, are getting away with something, that there should be a way to tax them more, or no?
You know, you can make the argument that you know, maybe there should be some sort of minimum contribution you need to make to the U.S. government each year, you know, once you have a certain amount of wealth, right? You could potentially make that argument. And in some sense, that's why you could make the claim about the wealth tax, right, being a way to get at that those concerns about fairness. The issue when you're starting to tax, the issue when you're starting to tax capital, unrealized capital gains, is unlike a wealth tax or let's say even a head tax, where we're going to say we're going to tax everybody in the country who makes, you know, who has a certain amount of wealth, $1 million a year. Right? That's not going to change behavior because, right, you pay it just by virtue of your existence. But a change in how you tax capital gains will change behavior in ways that are actually problematic for the economy. So it's not as though the money that is in those, that is in the, that is in some sense inside those stocks that you own, those unrealized gains, that is not money that you necessarily, right, have earned in the sense of income, because that stock could become worthless tomorrow, could drop in value by 20% tomorrow. And so to tax it, right, will create potentially perverse incentives, where you're going to be forced, if you're a small business owner, maybe to have to sell part of your business off or sell shares in your business in order to cover the taxes. Or you're going to be thinking about, well, should I be investing in this endeavor if I think that I'm going to now have to pay a tax hit, so I'm not going to be able to plan for the future in the same way? So it's going to shift how people think about what they're doing when they're investing in stocks for the long run, or investing in their companies in the long run, or being entrepreneurs in the long run. And, you know, even Democrats who are in favor of ensuring that the wealthy pay more in taxes are kind of sort of looking at this with quizzical look, saying, wait, what exactly, why are we creating this convoluted system for taxing the wealthiest Americans? There's got to be a better way to do this. And, you know, if put another way, if you as an American went to a financial planner and said, hey, I've got this great idea for how I'm going to raise revenue in the next 10 years, and it had all of these flaws in it, right? It's potentially unconstitutional, that you don't actually have a plan for how you're actually going to value companies and so on, that all of the details still need to be worked out. The financial planner would say, well, you really need to come back and you know, with a better sense of where you're headed, right? This doesn't make any sense. And that's sort of my perspective on this proposal. Even if you believe, and again, I think this is crucial, even if you believe that we need to have the wealthiest Americans pay more in taxes, it's hard for me to construct a more convoluted way to accomplish that goal.
We're talking about the Democrats' proposed wealth-style tax on billionaires, especially on unrealized gains from stocks and other things, with David Primo from the University of Rochester. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see some kind of tax on the very wealthiest Americans, additional tax, a wealth-based tax, for example? What do you think of this particular plan we've been talking about to say, if your stock values, for example, go up, we're going to tax you on the gains for that, for the wealthiest Americans? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about Democrats' plan to help pay for a roughly $2 trillion spending bill that would cover big social policy and climate initiatives, focusing on one funding mechanism, a plan to create a new tax on the investment incomes of billionaires and certain corporations, hoping to finalize plans this week. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, not a fan of the idea. Here's a listen to what he had to say on the Senate floor yesterday.
They're now proposing to tax money the American people haven't even made yet. Yes, you heard me right. So much for the quaint idea that you had to actually make money first before the IRS could tax it. Now Democrats want to tax money you haven't made yet.
Our guest is David Primo from the University of Rochester. He says, if you want to tax the wealthy more, this probably isn't the way to do it. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Tasha is with us in Madison. Tasha, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I definitely think the comments Senator McConnell made are just absurd. Like, the vast majority of Americans, it's not you, it's not us. He talks about it as if it's like the vast majority of us are investing. That is not an opportunity most people have in the United States because of vast income inequality. I absolutely agree with taxing wealthy Americans at a higher rate. We've done it in the past, and I think it's necessary given the amount of value they take from workers and from public tax items like highways and roads and infrastructure that they utilize every day for their businesses. I appreciate this conversation, but I also get really frustrated that it isn't the topic of where can we take money from is not brought up. We just approved a $740 billion budget for defense funding, and that was up $25 billion than what the Pentagon asked for. I would like to know why I'm not hearing Speaker Pelosi and Senator Schumer talk about where we can take money out of when we're spending billions of dollars basically terrorizing the rest of the world, and that money could go to spending on social programs, on housing, on healthcare. We could institute universal healthcare. So I really would like to hear less about how we can raise taxes and more about where we can take money from that we are already spending incredibly irresponsibly and unethically, in my opinion.
Tasha, thanks for the call. David Tasha with thoughts on both sides of the equation, income and spending. Anywhere you want to take that?
Yes, there's some important sentiments being expressed there. One is the idea that, you know, again, this is the belief, right? The wealthy should pay more in taxes. And I would go back to even many Democrats and liberals in the Senate and the House believe that there are better ways to accomplish that goal, right? So let's suppose we agree on the ends, increasing taxes on the wealthy. There are better approaches than taxing unrealized capital gains. The means is not really appropriate or unlikely to be as effective. The proposal that was on the table, which was to increase the marginal tax rate on income, as we currently define it, has been sort of put off the table because, again, of opposition from moderate Democrats. On the spending side, the concern there, right, is about defense spending and, you know, whether defense spending is too high. The reality, though, and this is where I think budget discussions get difficult, the reality is that even if you cut the defense budget basically to, you know, in half, right, that's not going to do much of anything to deal with the long run problems that we face with Social Security and Medicare. So what is actually driving our budgetary problems for the next 20 to 30 to 40 years is not defense. It is Social Security, it is Medicare, it is social programs. Now that's not to say, right, those social programs shouldn't remain in place, they shouldn't remain strong, but it is to say we need to be aware that to deal with, right, the fiscal problems that we face in the national debt, we need to address social programs. Defense is not going to be is not going to cut it, so to speak, right? But that doesn't mean, right, that you might not say that we still should have a cut in defense spending on moral grounds or on ethical grounds. But that's very different from saying that the reason we need to have it is because it's going to help deal with our budget problems. It's not going to make a dent really in the budget problems that the country faces.
Thanks for the call, Tasha. We'll go to Mike now in St. Lawrence. Mike, hi.
Hey, yeah, my question is, I've listened to the conversation so far, and what is your guest solution to solving this problem? As I told your screener that, I mean, Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world, yet he got a child tax credit last year because he didn't have enough. He didn't pay any income taxes. My question is, how do we fix that these people that are multi billionaires pay some taxes and help the country out?
Mike, thanks for the call. David?
Again, one proposal would be to increase the marginal tax rate that is levied on particularly high incomes. Now, again, you could argue, well, for somebody like Jeff Bezos, maybe he doesn't have any income on the books because His sole source of revenue is from, you know, is from taking loans out on the value of his Amazon mm-hmm. stock or something like that. And so that's, you know, that's the problem. But again, that would at least be one way to get a much broader base of tax revenue from a much wider share of Americans. I think the problem is that we're focused on these 700 very wealthy Americans, but all this is, you know, this proposal is only going to raise, quote unquote, again, only $250 billion over 10 years. That's not a big amount of money in a multi-trillion dollar budget. So the reality is that if you're going to raise, if your concern is that the wealthy are not paying their fair share, this isn't going to make a large share of wealthy Americans pay more in taxes. It's only going to affect, again, the very wealthy. And I guess I would make, this might be, you know, this may be just a difference of opinion in terms of the role of entrepreneurs in our society. But I would argue that that the contributions that billionaires like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk have made to American society far greater than the wealth that they personally own. So if you think about the changes in the world that we've seen from companies like Amazon, from companies like Tesla, right? Those are because of the entrepreneurial drive of those individuals, and the country is far better off in terms of those companies being in existence, right, than had they not existed. And so the notion that that billionaires have not contributed sufficiently to American society may be missing the fact that the reason that these particular individuals that always get the attention, the reason they are billionaires is because they fundamentally transform the world. Now, again, the listeners may disagree with that perspective, but I just wanted to throw that out there as something to consider.
Thanks for that call. And David, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
That's David Primo, professor of political science and business administration at the University of Rochester. We talked with him about the Democrats' plans for new taxes on billionaires. The move is aimed to help pay for President Biden's social services and climate change package. We focused on at least one current proposal on the table related to taxing unrealized gains on things like stock investments. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, hospital workers in the state have faced violence from patients and families. Find out what's going on and what it could take to make things safer at hospitals. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. It's National Pumpkin Day, so it's time for an update on the Long Island Cheese Pumpkin of Destiny. I mentioned on the show a while back that I got in the last share from my community-supported agriculture farm this massive, dense pumpkin. It's called a Long Island Cheese Pumpkin, or Long Island Cheese Squash. It's short but really wide, and with its pale color, it looks kind of like a big wheel of cheese, hence the name. It's really big. Correction, it was really big. I finally cooked it down this weekend. I cut it into quarters and baked it in a roasting pan during the Packers game. Had to do it in two rounds. The whole thing wouldn't fit in at once. I measured out a bunch of doses of cooked pumpkin in 1 and 2 cup servings for baking, a couple big containers on top of that for soup or whatever. Didn't measure them precisely, but I got somewhere from 18 to 20 cups of pumpkin out of that one guy. If you don't cook a lot, that's a lot of pumpkin. It's all in the freezer. What have I cooked with it so far? Nothing yet, but I'm going to live on it for a while now. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, do you believe in ghosts? A lot of people do. Around half of all Americans believe in the supernatural. How much can science explain our preference for the paranormal? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, we recently got a very tasty, very controversial question from a listener.
I'm Marissa Wojcik from Madison, and my question is, why do cream puffs get all the attention when the Kringle is the official state pastry of Wisconsin?
When we asked Marissa to explain a little more about her question, she explained that growing up in the Eau Claire area, her family would often have Kringle at family gatherings, so there's some strong nostalgia there. But she says her experience with the jewel of the Wisconsin State Fair, the cream puff, wasn't as impressive. She says maybe she just didn't get a good one. We're here to help Marissa out and try to get to the bottom of what makes each of them popular and which one is the ultimate Wisconsin pastry. and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in Cream Puff's corner? Are you squarely a Kringle person? If we had to put one of them, one of those pastries on the state flag, and I say why not, which one would it be? Call in now with your vote. Which do you insist visitors have? If you can get into the state fair for that Cream Puff, get them out to the Kringle store for the Kringle. 800-642-1234 is the number. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I think we got a poll up there. Paula Hare is with us from Team Cream Puff. She's Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puff, the outfit responsible for producing all those puffs every year at State Fair. Paula, welcome to Central Time.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so proud to represent Original Cream Puffs in this discussion.
And Shauna Seaver is with us for a look at both pastries. She writes and talks about food for television, radio, and the web. She's the author of the cookbook, Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. Shauna, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Paula, let's start with you. Can you just, you know, for people who haven't been to State Fair and had that cream puff there, just give us the basics. What are we biting into there?
Oh, well, our cream puffs contain or really are made from Wisconsin dairy-rich cream and also a very wonderful puff pastry. And biting into them is just like a little piece of heaven. They're only made during this 11-day run of the state fair. That is our original cream puffs. And it's just such a nostalgic, wonderful feeling that fairgoers have in just tasting that first cream puff.
And I think for people in Wisconsin, if you hear the words cream puff, you're thinking state fair, along with fried blank on a
Correct.
Stick. It is the food of the state fair. How did that happen? Why did cream puffs become the Wisconsin State Fair pastry of choice?
Well, certainly cream puffs have been a signature dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair since 1924. So we're coming up on 100 years of cream puffs here at the Wisconsin State Fair. It is certainly the most popular and longest running food item at the State Fair. I mean, picture in your mind, you know, all of the sights and sounds of the fair and the giant Ferris wheel lights. And, you know, the cream puffs is having your first cream puff or a cream puff is certainly an experience just like going to the fair. So 1924, that's when they started as a dairy state favorite.
Now, Shauna, before we move over to Kringle, and you're not necessarily, this isn't a debate exactly, but do you have some thoughts on the cream puff as a Midwestern dessert or pastry, I should say?
Well, cream puffs are delightful. What's not to like? This is the most friendly debate ever.
Right.
No, I think cream puffs are great, and especially their place in, you know, Wisconsin food culture. It's just what you said. I mean, it's that nostalgic feel of the state fair, and it's something special that you're not going to have all the time. I mean, and it's something that's like towering and beautiful and delightful and a little over the top. And I think it's just, it definitely has a place, you know, and anything I think that we have, you know, whether it's something, a family recipe we only have at Christmas time, for example, it's going to give you a certain type of delight, right? So that's where I think the cream puff kind of holds a place in our hearts.
So cream puff is the official state fair pastry, but the Kringle is the official Wisconsin state pastry. Why is Kringle such a, I love Kringle. Why is Kringle such a big thing in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, Kringle came to Wisconsin in the late 1800s when there was a huge boom of immigrants from all over Europe in particular, and Wisconsin took a lot of them in. And it was a place where people could come and farm and really create a new life. And of course, there's lots of beautiful land in Wisconsin. And so it became a sort of landing place for a lot of very baking-centric countries, lucky for Wisconsin. And the Kringle was, you know, an invention from Denmark, originally actually started out in a sort of pretzel shape, and you still find them in Denmark baked in that way. And then, like so many other baked goods, sort of evolve as they land in their new home. And like any innovative group of immigrants, they sort of tweaked the Kringle a little bit for local tastes, and it's been around ever since.
We're talking to Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland, and Paula Hare from Original Cream Puff. We were talking about, Which is the real Wisconsin pastry? The cream puff associated with State Fair, the Kringle, which is the official state pastry. You could join in with your thoughts on either of those, or if you want to nominate a third-party candidate, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Okay, Paula, with Kringle, I know I can get in a lot of flavors. I can get raspberry. I can get lesser flavors, too. The cream puff, mostly we think of the straight-up cream. There have been some variations, though, right? I think I've seen a chocolate cream puff at the fair, if I'm not mistaken.
That's exactly right. Our original cream puffs are the iconic, the most iconic dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair. And for almost 100 years, it's been the original cream puff as our only flavor. Now, since COVID, like all other companies and bakeries, we have had to pivot. Now, we've had our loyal followers ask us for many years to explore some different flavors, and we were always true to our original cream puffs. But during COVID, we thought maybe this is the time to offer at a very limited time, just like our original cream puffs, only available for 11 days, maybe we should try some different flavors and just see what the community thought of those flavors. And they've gone over like great gangbusters, let me tell you.
What's been the biggest hit for new flavors?
For new flavors, it's been the pumpkin spice cream puffs. So we just had pumpkin spice during Harvest Fest at State Fair. And I can't quite spill the beans, but perhaps there might be a new flavor for the holidays. So I think your listeners will have to check with you or go to Wisconsin or originalcreampuffs.com and check out what our new flavor may or may not be.
Okay, Sean, I got a question for you. Say there's this guy who's a pretty good cook, but he's a so-so baker. So, Shauna, what would be easier for this guy to make at home, a Kringle or a cream puff?
Well, I would say a cream puff is quite a bit simpler in terms of, I mean, not, you know, flavor is wonderful. The textures are wonderful. But in terms of the technique, a choux pastry, which is what a cream puff is typically based on, and then the cream are sort of your two elements. And choux pastry comes together rather quickly, and you can bake it, you know, straight out of the mixer. And it starts on the stovetop, and then you finish it off in a mixer, and then you can dollop your puffs, and then they're baked off. Not sure how Paula makes hers. We're not going to pressure her to divulge her secrets, but
it's
generally
a very closely guarded secret, Shauna.
Yeah, I believe it is because they're delicious. And then when you're talking about Kringle, it's actually based on a Danish pastry, which is kind of similar to a French puff pastry, but there's the addition of yeast, which gives it a little more rise and, of course, that delicious flavor. But it's a laminated dough, which essentially means that you're going to incorporate the butter by rolling and folding the dough several times. And in Midwest Made, in my book, I have a shortcut Danish pastry where you incorporate the butter a little bit differently, and it's a little bit more manageable for the home baker with limited counter real estate. But it involves a lot of rolling and turning and chilling in between rolling. So it can be a couple day process to make yourself a good Kringle, which I think is something that a lot of us take for granted because it's, as you said in the introduction, it's something easy to sort of grab and have, you know, for coffee breaks, but they really are very well-crafted, time-consuming pastry.
Well, I'm going to let both of you go and turn things over to our callers now. Shauna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Paula, thanks for being with us.
Oh my gosh, happy to be here.
I've been hearing from Paula Hare, Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puff, and Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. We are talking about the Wisconsin pastry. Is it the cream puff from the State Fair, or is it the Kringle, the actual current Wisconsin official state pastry? What do you think? 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Rusk County. Mike, hi.
Hi. You know, I'm just going to say it's, you know, just look around the state, and that pretty much tells you right there that it's Kringle. I can go to, and I have been in, like, Quick Trip stores or other convenience stores or small grocery stores, and I can find a Racine cooked Kringle in a number of different flavors. but I would say I would be hard pressed to find a single Wisconsinite that can find a cream puff anywhere other than the state fair one time a year, maybe a couple of times a year. That right there tells me if it was so popular and so awesome, and I'm not saying cream puffs are bad, I love them, but if they were so awesome, you'd be finding them everywhere.
And Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Heartfelt opinion there. I love it. We'll go now to Lily in La Crosse. Lily, hello.
Hello. I'm going to say I'm Team Kringle. I love Kringles. They are delicious with the fruit filling. And, yeah, you can't go wrong with that. And I will say, I was trying to think of the brand of Kringle that I'm most familiar with. And it was coming from Racine. And I can't remember the name, but it's in that wax.
I'm guessing it's Racine Kringle.
Fold.
That's the brand is Racine Kringle. Yep. What favorite flavor before I let you go, Lily?
Oh, gosh, strawberry. But the most recent one I had was a pumpkin one, and that was really good.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Lily. Well, that fits with what people said on our Twitter survey, a strong Kringle lean, 65%. How about you? It is Kringle versus Cream Puff for Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. Which is your favorite? Do you go to State Fair in hopes of getting that Cream Puff? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation here for more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about Wisconsin's dueling pastries, answering a Why Scotson question, saying why do cream puffs get so much hype when Kringle is the official state pastry? It's cream puff. It's Kringle. Which one has your heart, mind, and taste bud? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Thanks, Rob. I want to be careful because I both of these have their place, and I would vote for either one. They're both fantastic. But as a former baker, I've made a ton of both, and I know what the product is supposed to taste like. If you get a soggy cream puff in Wisconsin, it's because it's been sitting around and the whipped cream has started to dissolve, and you know, because those are supposed to be nice and crisp against this softness of the whipped cream. You know what I'm saying? Now, the Kringle is a Danish dough, like the lady was saying. It's laminated, and it's supposed to puff. Well, I've made plenty of Danish in my time. That which makes a Kringle is what I call a mistake. we've all done something in the kitchen where, you know, it's still edible, but it didn't turn out the way you wanted it to. And if you cut a Kringle, or when you cut a Kringle in half and you look at the laminations, the layers of the dough, the more you get into the center, you realize that that dough in the middle is not fully cooked. What I'm trying to say, Rob, is originally it was supposed to be Danish, but the yeast died before it could do its job of puff up the pastry. But it's still edible. It has a unique texture. It's still very good.
Now, hold on. Jim. You give me a Danish and you give me a Kringle. I'm taking the Kringle every time. But you're saying a Kringle is just a mistake in Danish?
Try this, Rob. If you ever make Danish dough, it's a pain because of the lamination. But the lady said she's got a quick one. But don't use the yeast. Or if you use the yeast, use like 1/10 of the yeast, okay? And see what the product, see what the final product is like, okay? Because it only rises slightly. The air that's in between the layers is from the lamination. Mm. That's when the fat melts away, okay?
All right, Jim, thanks for sharing some of the technique behind the Kringle. I love it. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Rick in Nina. Rick, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I'm not really a fan of either of those two baked goods. I would argue and say that the brat bun is what we should be talking about.
The brat bun. Okay, but would you ever eat a brat bun, you know, without, say, I don't know, a brat in the middle of it?
No, but if you're talking Wisconsin, right, and raw bun is definitely like what I think of, right? I don't eat Kringles and I don't eat cream puffs.
Gotcha.
I don't care for either of them.
I love
but
it.
But I definitely eat raw bun.
All right. What condiment before I let you go, Rick?
Mustard.
Mustard, same. All right. Thanks a lot. A vote for the brat bun for the official pastry of Wisconsin. We are talking about Wisconsin pastry. Which pastry says Wisconsin to you? Is it the cream puff made famous at the state fair? Is it Kringle made famous as Wisconsin's official state pastry? Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us from by Hudson. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to submit another entry. Besides the Kringle and the cream puff, when our family thinks of Wisconsin desserts, we think of the wonderful Norske Nook pies from Osseo, Wisconsin.
Oh, now are you thinking the pies in general or one in particular?
One in particular, I would have to say, is the coconut cream pie. It has a mile-high meringue. You can't really even put it in a box. It's delicious. It's one of our family favorites.
It sounds great, but let me throw this at you. Key ingredient there is coconut. We can't grow that in Wisconsin. Can we still make that our official Wisconsin pastry or dessert?
Well, then let's say any of their wonderful pies that have a meringue or a very high mound of whipped cream on top, that's the Wisconsin dessert to me.
Sounds great, Tom. Thank you. Didn't mean to give you a hard time there, but definitely an iconic Wisconsin dessert item there. Let's go back to your calls now. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hi.
Hi, I'd like to vote for the, I like them both, but I think the Kringle is by far the state pastry. And I've had Racine Kringle, but I'll tell you the best Kringle I've had is from Lane's Bakery here in Madison.
Okay, yeah, that's the thing. I haven't gone out and explored a lot of different companies or bakeries' Kringles. Are you a connoisseur? Have you tried them in a lot of different places?
Well, I've had various different Kringles, but as I said, I've really honed in on Lane's, and I like their cherry raspberry. Or cherry cheese are my two favorites.
You had me a cherry raspberry and cherry cheese. Thanks a lot for the call and the recommendation. Might have to check that out. We'll go now to Rana in Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm going to throw a wrench into all of this.
Oh, no.
Because I'm a seasonal believer here in Wisconsin. That's why I live here. So I'm going to say cream puff for the summer. The best caramel apple from the best little pumpkin farm you can find in Wisconsin. The Kringle in the winter and the brat bun gets a vote for me for summer.
A bread,
spring.
A pastry for all seasons. I love it. Now, like if I gave you a cream puff in, I don't know, winter, are you going to slap it out of my hand or will you still eat it out of season?
You know, I'll eat it out of season, but I'll have to give it some thought.
Excellent. Rana, I love that. Four pastries to rule them all. That sounds great. We're talking about the best pastry in Wisconsin, the iconic pastry of Wisconsin. It started with a Wisconsin question about cream puff versus Kringle. You can weigh in with other nominations. 800-642-1234 is the number. Eric joins us next in Hazel Green. Eric, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Eric?
I am a Sheboygan hard roll guy.
Sheboygan hard rolls. I've eaten them. Tell us what they are and what you do with them.
Well, I was born in Sheboygan County, and we've eaten brats on Sheboygan hard rolls forever, and I've since moved out of Sheboygan County, and oh, it hurts not have a brat on a Sheboygan hard roll.
Do you get care packages from back home, Eric, with the Sheboygan hard rolls?
Whenever family comes to visit, they must bring them.
Excellent. Another great nominee. Thank you for that, Eric. Let's go to Dave now in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hey, I think I can solve this for everybody and we can move on.
What's your solution?
It's if you're looking for the pastry for the state of Wisconsin, it's the Kringle.
The Kringle.
You may know of it as Kringle, but it's Kringle is the way it's properly pronounced.
In the original Danish, or?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, somewhere, something like that. But the official thing of the Wisconsin State Fair, there you go, cream puffs. But think about how many cream puffs you see in the state of Wisconsin other than August 5th through the 24th.
Check. I got you, Dave. Thanks for that. Time for at least one more caller. Jennifer is with us in Waukesha. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that for me, the Kringles are just way too sweet. I've only had the Racine Kringles, and to me, they're inedible. They're just way too sweet. So I'm voting for the Cream Puff if that's where it goes.
So the Cream Puffs aren't too... You're right. They aren't like crazy super sweet. So the breading part isn't as sweet. So that makes the difference for you, a little less sweet?
Yeah, it does. Even the filling isn't... it's cream and a little bit of powdered sugar, but yeah, they seem to be reasonable.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Thanks to everybody who called in. Wow, so many comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page as well. Let's read a couple. Mary wrote, Kringles represent Wisconsin. I'd rather eat a cream puff. Tim wrote, the pastry that says Wisconsin to me, the neighborhood bakeries that made and sold them when I was a kid. Ted says, Kringle, cream puffs are just a hamburger bun with whipped cream. Them's fighting words. Cody said, hey, it seems like an Eastern Wisconsin debate over the whole thing. Keep sharing yours over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tomorrow, check out a new episode of Mapped Out. That's tomorrow on Central Time.